yourselves.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars. Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network. It is a pleasure to be with you. We have a lot to talk about today, beginning with this. A brand new poll shows that a plurality of voters, not quite a majority, is planning to repeal Washington State's foolish carbon tax known as the Climate Commitment Act. Thank God for that. I want to get into the details of that in just a moment. But first, welcome to the program. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every single day on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 25 years with honestly provocative talk. The way to get in? 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, you know how much we love naysayers on this program. We suffer them gladly. 866-439-5277. If you want to send an email instead, that's easy too. talk@LarsLarson.com. And of course, you can always answer our poll on X. The question today, we try to make it fresh and current. Should the Secret Service, which has already failed President Donald Trump, should it demand that he stop his huge rallies? Now, one of the key things about President Trump, since he left the presidency and began running again, and that was nearly 4 years ago, he has had the ability to go just about anywhere in America and draw crowds of thousands, in some cases, tens of thousands of Americans who show up to see him. And they will show up and they will spend hours out of a day, hours to drive there, get through the security, sit waiting for the president. I've been to events where a president speaks. As a reporter, it is usually a long and torturous day. So what does the Secret Service do? They have already admitted that they had a colossal failure on the 13th of July when they failed to protect Donald Trump, failed in ways that were so plain right on the face that even a layperson, somebody who doesn't have any expertise in police or security work, could look at that and say, you left the rooftop unguarded. You let a young man with a rifle up on top of that rooftop. You identified him as a threat more than half an hour before he took those shots, and you didn't do anything to protect President Donald Trump? No, they didn't. So you know what the Secret Service has done now? The same failed agency that failed to protect President Donald Trump from a would-be assassin's bullet is now asking, in effect demanding, that he stop holding large outdoor campaign rallies. Now, I'll tell you what, if you go all the way back to 2016 when Hillary Clinton ran against Donald Trump and lost, she couldn't draw a crowd to fill a church on a good day. She had a tough time drawing a crowd at all. Donald Trump had no problem all those years ago drawing massive crowds of supporters. So what are they going to do? Well, they got to have a way to interfere with an American election. So now you've got an executive branch agency, because remember, the Secret Service works for Homeland Security. Homeland Security is an agency directly under the control of the head of the Biden crime family, Joseph R. Biden of Delaware. Now, what is the Secret Service saying? You got to stop all these big outdoor rallies. Either hold them indoors. We can't protect you. Now, this agency has already failed in front of all of us in a massive way, and now they're admitting, we're simply going to tell you we can't protect you if you're out of doors. And are they going to apply the same set of rules to, say, Joe Biden or now Kamala Harris? You can find the X poll online at Lars Larson Show on X. You can find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday, I asked you about the fact that Great Britain had decided, and I think it was a good decision, block the use of puberty blockers in children. this so-called transgender, gender-affirming care, because Great Britain concluded it is dangerous for children to have those drugs applied to them. I think America should do the same. And yet the prediction was made, if you stop using those puberty blockers, if you stop doing gender-affirming care, a lot of those kids are going to kill themselves. And yet now, an independent review shows the suicide rates did not change. So, should America do the same? I said yes. 97% of you said yes. Only 3% were naysayers in that X poll. Now, let me tell you about the Climate Commitment Act. There's a brand new poll out that shows that voters are planning to trash the Climate Commitment Act and get rid of it. And well, they should. I'll remind you of a couple of facts. The legislature passed this nonsense. They said, we're going to raise a few $100 million. They have raised 10 times that amount of money. They have taken $2 billion out of the pockets of citizens under the guise that we're going to fix the environment and save planet Earth. So Brian Haywood put up the money. I've never actually met Brian in person. He's been on the show a number of times. He put up millions of dollars to get six initiatives to the legislature approved. Now, what's an initiative to the legislature? It's when the citizens are demanding that their state lawmakers change the laws on a number of things. In this case, six different issues. And yet the legislature refuses to do what the people demand. So you put an initiative to the legislature together. Haywood got gigantic numbers of people to sign those initiatives, far more than was required. And on three of the six issues, the legislature finally caved in. Said, we wouldn't do it unless we were forced to, but now you forced us to, and they caved in on those three issues. The other three go to the ballot in November, and one of them would repeal the Climate Commitment Act. And what has that done? Well, it was supposed to raise a couple of $100 million for saving the planet, and it was going to be a slush fund of money that the legislature and state bureaucrats could spend any way they want. 6 months into the Climate Commitment Act, it had already raised gasoline taxes more than 25 cents a gallon, maybe even a lot more than that, but at least 25 cents a gallon. It was peeling millions of dollars out of the pockets of everybody who drives a car. And it brought in the first 6 months, as much money as the legislature had forecast it would raise in 10 years. Now, what does that mean? You know what it means? It means they lied. They said, we're only going to raise a small amount of money, and they got $2 billion in a giant slush fund. And now they don't want to repeal it themselves, so voters have to do it. This brand new poll shows that 48% of the people asked said they would vote yes to repeal the Climate Commitment Act. Only 34% would vote no. That's a 14-point spread. Now, what does that mean? It means we've got to get to the polls and vote for the repeal of the Climate Commitment Act. There is already plurality support in favor of that. And why shouldn't there be? The legislature lies to you, says we're only going to raise a small amount of money. And then they get a gigantic $2 billion slush fund because they lied to the voters. And then the legislature refused to fix the problem. It even refused to insist that the law be followed because agriculture was supposed to be 100% exempt from the Climate Commitment Act taxes. And the state bureaucracy said, we're too busy to actually follow the law. In this case, slap them upside the head with a metaphorical 2x4 and repeal the Climate Commitment Act. It's going to get done in November, and the lawmakers who passed this nonsense should be ashamed. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Coming up in a moment in the Northwest Nonsense, we'll talk about a bad district attorney who's going to throw a gigantic advantage to criminals in court, and that's coming next.
Sometimes the truth is awkward.
You know what the Muslims call the Jews in the Quran? The children of Israel. Well, this is awkward.
Now, more truth from Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. Nonsense.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
Multnomah County voters decided that Mike Schmidt for Brains made a bad district attorney over the last 4 years, so at the polls they gave him a pink slip. And now this progressive loser throws a gift to criminals that he's supposed to prosecute. This week, the criminal-friendly DA Schmidt Show announced he's going to cripple the cases that his prosecutors bring against some accused criminals. When a court picks a jury, the rules allow for both defense and prosecution to raise two kinds of challenges to any prospective juror. Cause is one of them. It's like having a juror who says, yeah, my brother-in-law is the defendant. He can be challenged for cause. The other one is called a peremptory challenge, where both sides get a certain number of jurors that they can refuse to seat without giving a reason. Three of them in each misdemeanor case for each side, defense and prosecution. Six peremptory challenges for felony trials. So the DA gives up the prosecutor's challenges, and that gives the defendants a good-sized advantage not required by the law. Just like most of the things this guy has done, declining to prosecute thousands of criminal cases and befriending Antifa and BLM, the DA's actions in this case, Mike Schmidt Show, benefit the criminals. Having been fired by the voters, but he's still on the job another 6 months, Schmidt for Brains plans to do as much damage as he possibly can on his way out the door and raise a big middle finger to law-abiding citizens. Your calls are welcome on this Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day is posed in an email I got, and at the request of the sender, I left the name off, and I understand why. What do you do when your labor union orders you to go out on strike and you disagree? The person wrote, first, I want to say I'm a current employee at New Seasons. That's a food market. And have received news today, the union that has never had a full deal with our company is threatening to vote a strike on August 7th. Few of us employees that don't agree with this union or its beliefs have no recourse against it, and we're trying to find a way to stop it. This union has shown anti-cop sentiment, anti-Israel sentiment, with pro-Palestine protests over the summer. The few employees that I know, plus myself, that disagree with this union have had no way to fight against it. I'm sending this email in the hopes I can reach out to somebody who could give us some advice or help us remove this union from our stores. Thank you. And at his request, I left the signature off. You know what my suggestion is? If your union goes on strike, you go to the boss and say, boss, I'll be happy to fill in for all those striking workers. I don't side with the union, and nobody's going to tell me what I can do. Now, are you going to get the cold shoulder from the ones who are the union true believers? Absolutely, you will. But exercise your rights as an American. If you want to work, you can go ahead and work. And yeah, you'll get called some nasty names. So does Donald Trump. And you know what those nasty names do? He either adopts them or he lets them slide right off his back. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Well, how about this? Portland is considering a plan to more than double your property taxes to support parks and arts. I mean, so you've got both the states of Oregon and Washington that continually raise taxes. Climate Commitment Act and a couple of billion dollars in Washington. And now what does Portland want to do? They have a current parks levy that is 80 cents per $1,000 on a house. That means an average house with an assessed value of $265,000, like anybody can find a house for $250,000 anywhere in Multnomah County, that's a couple of $100. The more realistic estimate is it's about $400 or $500. Money from the levy, which is one-third of the Parks Bureau's annual operating budget, is used to spruce up the parks in the natural areas. If you've been to one of their parks recently, have you seen any sign that that money is actually doing that? Because I haven't. On top of that, every single Portland resident age 18 or older with an income above $1,000 a year, with a household living above the poverty level, owes the annual arts tax of $35. People hate that tax. So what are they proposing to do instead? They want to take the tax from 80 cents per 1,000 value of a house to $1.80, more than double. which means the average resident is probably going to have to pay about $1,000 extra. Anybody's in favor of that? I think I'm going to give them the Daily Grill. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. David writes in, Lars, your idea about making employers prove they're hiring legal employees instead of illegal aliens or lose the ability to deduct their wages is brilliant. Better than E-Verify, hats off to you. We need to get some Congress people behind that. I believe we need to deport all the illegals or the message gets out that you get in and you get to stay. We can't have that, and we have a country that has much less of our standard of living. If this continues much longer, we're all going to suffer a big drop in our standard of living. Signed, David. And I think David's absolutely right about that. In fact, later on today, I'm going to talk about a brand new poll out, a national poll that shows a majority of Americans support Donald Trump's plan for a mass deportation of illegal aliens. I'm simply suggesting that using the tax code and employers is virtually cost-free and would begin to have an effect before the law even took effect. And I'm glad to debate it anytime with a naysayer. To your calls now on this Wednesday at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And vote in our X poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show. Gary, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hello. I'm calling from Bend, and I'm an ex-Vietnam vet and also 20 years as a cop and investigator.
Thanks for your
service.
I've
noticed something that, you're welcome, sir. And I have not heard anyone speak about what I'm about to say to you. Never heard anyone on the news talk about it. But within 12 hours after the attempted assassination, the FBI came out and said he acted alone, and there is no
Gary,
way.
I don't believe that's true, because I watched the news conferences on the afternoon after the attempted assassination, and all of them said, it appears he acted alone, but we're leaving all possibilities open, and that continued for several days. So I heard nobody from the FBI or Secret Service or anyone else saying, they can say they believe, and at this point, have they found any evidence that he was acting in concert, any of his communications, any of his meetings that would indicate he was working with somebody else? I think it's still a possibility. But at this point, have you seen any evidence that he was working in concert with anyone else?
Well, no. Only the stuff I've heard on the news about him having three encrypted accounts overseas. The fact that this guy was allowed in broad daylight after warnings from citizens to walk up, get up on a roof, and shoot, that I just have the feeling that he was allowed to do. Maybe he wasn't hired to do it, but I think he was allowed.
The Secret Service deliberately downsized the protection around Donald Trump. They have now admitted that they turned down many requests for additional security for the Trump campaign. They simply said no, and they gave four times the protection to Jill Biden.
The Lars Larson Show. Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk, but fair warning, if you're listening to this show, you're likely on the FBI's most wanted list. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and I'm glad to welcome back our friend Aaron Mesh, managing editor for Willamette Week. You can find the stories he talks about at WWeek.com. Aaron, how are you?
Good. How are you, Lars?
Not too bad, but I'm really angry because I just told my audience how the state of Washington got sold a bill of goods on a tax hike called the Climate Commitment Act when they said, oh, we're only going to raise a little bit of money. And then they brought in as much in 6 months as they had told citizens they were going to take in 10 years. And now you've got this story about how Oregon's deep state bureaucracy got caught lying so they could justify a tax hike, saying, you know, if we just raise taxes on beer and wine and stuff like that, people will drink a whole lot less and they will, you know, they will go away from their alcohol problems. And that turned out to be a big fat lie, didn't it?
No, actually, it's the exact opposite.
It's the opposite.
What my story says, what Lucas Manfield's story says.
I think you may have misheard me. I said they said if we increase tax on beer and wine, it will curb excessive drinking. And it turned out the report actually said the opposite, right?
No, I'm sorry. Like what the story says is that there was a report that did say the opposite, but the problem is the report is based on studies funded by the alcohol industry.
So the end result of that was that they bury the report, the agency?
They buried the report because they looked at it and saw that both the CDC and others objected to what the report said because of the fact that it was funded by alcohol industry studies, which made it soiled. It's basically a corrupt study. And so when they buried it, then the Oregonian and a lot of Republicans got very upset that it was buried, and the agency unburied it and posted it online. The problem is that the research that they've posted online is fundamentally flawed.
Is it, and when you dug in, or when Lucas Manfield dug into the details of this, he found it wasn't just the funding and who paid for it, but the research itself had flaws?
It did. In particular, sorry, I'm going to have to look to see what in particular is that the analysis left out studies that had contradictory findings. In other words, things that didn't agree with their priors, they just didn't include in the study.
Oh, I see. So they filtered the information, and it was filtered by the industry. Because in most cases, aren't studies of almost anything done by the industries that do business in that thing? Like studies of windmills are often done by windmill companies and the like?
Sure. That often gets done. Studies of tobacco are funded by RJ
Reynolds. Tobacco company.
It's not uncommon, but it does lead to real questions about the quality of the work. And my main concern here is that OHA simply just hasn't been transparent in this process. From beginning to end, there's been a lack of transparency. First, they buried the study. Then they unburied the study but never explained to anybody, including their agency director, why they buried it in the first place. Now they're going to put up the CDC concerns about the study, which I think is a step in the right direction on transparency of at least acknowledging what the problem was to begin with. I just look at a situation like this, and I'm not sure what the right policy decision is on the tax, but I get very tired of state bureaucrats deciding to filter what it is that I can and cannot know, and including things that might criticize their work. And that's,
you
I think, what the
both.
Fundamental part of this. This is what the fundamental point of this story is. It's not that we're advocating, hey, let's go raise our taxes again. We're saying, tell us what you know and tell us who objects to what you said.
Yeah. And because, Aaron, ultimately, at the end of the day, the point I was trying to make is that if they'd wanted to come into the state and say, you want to raise taxes, you think it'll curb drinking, fine. There are studies that show it does. There are studies that show it doesn't. Here's one study that says it doesn't, but it does come from the alcohol industry. That's one flaw. And second flaw, we'll show you where in the study they haven't done the study the right way or considered the right things. We're just going to put all the info in front of you. These are people in the, I would call it the deep state of the state of Oregon, in the bureaucracy, who've decided, we have to filter the information we give to the people who actually make the decision, state lawmakers elected by the people, so that they will make the decision we want them to make. And we want to withhold from them information that would be inconvenient to our argument. Is that fair? Is a fair way of summing it up?
I think that's a completely fair way of summing it up. There's this constant problem they have over there that, I mean, it's know-it-all-ism, right? Like this concept that like we know better than you, so therefore like we don't have to tell you how we did our work. And it is like frankly pretty infuriating that first you would bury a report, then you would unbury a report and never say why it was you buried it in the first place. Then we have to go find out why it was that you buried it in the first place and discover, well, now you have a report posted that many people believe is fundamentally flawed. Wouldn't you want to tell them the report was flawed? No, you just want to bury it and never see it again, which is crazy to me.
Well, and the other thing is that if somebody who's now lied to me two or three times by burying the report, then unburying it, but not telling me why and all the rest of that, am I right to suspect if they've lied to me a couple, three times, maybe this is also a lie when they say these are the flaws of the study, or are you telling me everything you know about that? I don't think I trust these people at all at that point.
Well, Well, there is that classic, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, we won't be fooled again.
Exactly. And so what do you do about a problem? And I guess what I'd ask is, since the Democrats are in charge, they have the vast majorities in the state agencies, in elected officials statewide, and in both houses of the legislature, is there any consequence when people from an agency come and lie, effectively lie to the legislature, or lie by omission?
It's a great question. We'll keep asking that question. I'm quite confident, and I'm sure you will too.
Well, I'm not sure that they want to have there be a consequence, and let me propose this to you. An awful lot of the people who are the lawmakers in the majority, members of the Democrat Party, and that's significant because they get an awful lot of money from labor unions who represent a whole bunch of people, virtually all the state employees or all the significant state employees. So they're getting all this money from their labor unions. The minute they start coming down hard on state employees saying, hey, you lied to us or you kept stuff from us, then maybe they put their friends in the labor unions in an awkward spot, and then maybe they're not as crazy about giving money to Democrats anymore.
Well, I think that you've described a fundamental flaw in the system that we have written about a lot, which is the degree to which public employee unions hold captive many of the lawmakers in Salem.
Which means that as a state lawmaker, even if you're a, say, good-hearted Democrat, if I can go that far and imagine that person, that they say, well, there ought to be a consequence if somebody comes to us and lies to us or keeps stuff from us that we need to know, so I'm going to get that person fired. And then, of course, you engender antipathy from the very people that you consider your allies, and they don't like it either, and then you pay the consequences for that. It's the kind of nepotism, or I guess financial nepotism, that keeps governments at every level screwed up.
Well, look at what happened to Paul Hovey down in Eugene. I mean, you're aware of the enormous amount of money that UFCW spent trying to recall him simply because he wouldn't vote for a bill they wanted.
United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Yeah, you go up against the unions, you're in trouble, which means you've got school boards that are held captive by the teachers union. You got state employees unions that hold the lawmakers captive. And all of us get to pay the bill with the taxes that we pay to Salem and Olympia. I mean, it's a really screwed up situation. Maybe what we should do is say, if you're doing any business with the state, including labor unions that do business with the state, in Illinois, if you do more than $50,000 business, which is nothing, with a state agency, you can't give one thin dime to anybody seeking public office. And for all the corruption in Illinois, I think that would be a good rule. You can find the story about Lucas Manfield at WWeek.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Now, a brand new poll shows that Washington voters are ready to reject that illegal capital gains tax. And I'll get to that and your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. No.
What does Lars think about smoking the devil's lettuce?
I won't go schizo, will I?
There's a distinct possibility.
Now it's time to take a hit of Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program and the Radio Northwest Network. I want to tell you about a new poll about Washington voters who are ready to reject an illegal capital gains tax foisted on them by the state legislature. We'll get to that in just a moment. First, welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. I want you to vote in our X poll as well. Today's question, should the Secret Service, which has already failed President Donald Trump once, should it demand, as they have, that he stop his huge rallies? Well, so far, the campaign says, okay, we won't do any for now. But the fact that the Secret Service failed so miserably and is now saying we just can't protect a candidate or maybe even the president of the United States or the vice president in an open public rally. If that's the case, somebody else needs to be running the Secret Service because they're admitting they can't do what that agency has been able to do successfully for decades. So should the Secret Service demand that Donald Trump stop his huge outdoor rallies. I would say no to that, even though he's already agreed to do so. But he's under threat from the Secret Service. They're effectively putting him on notice. Hold some more of those rallies, and we're not responsible. Well, you haven't been responsible so far in the last few weeks, so why would we expect it now? And I hate to say that, having known some people in the Secret Service. Our ex-poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let me go first to Tommy. Hey, Tommy, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Regarding the question of the day about the union member who disagreed with his union's position on a strike and what to do.
Yeah.
My first question for that person would be, when's the last time you went to a union meeting?
Well, let me ask you something,
second,
Tommy. He says this union that represents or purports to represent workers at New Seasons, he says they've never had a full deal with the company. Now, I don't know the details on what's going on at New Seasons, but I hope you're aware. You sound like you may be a member of a labor union. Am I right?
Oh, retired. I was a member of multiple unions over many years.
Okay. Do you know what card check is these days?
Nope, never heard of it.
It's a subterfuge that's used by unions to trick people, and here's how it works. You're working somewhere, and there's no union there, and somebody comes by and says, hey, would you like to have an election to decide whether or not we're going to have a union? And they hand you a card. Now, you sound like you're pro-union. You might have signed it anyway. But if somebody says, yeah, I really don't want a union, but yeah, let's have an election, and if a majority of employees vote for it, then we'll have the union. And they sign the card check. Do you know what that does the minute they get half the employees to sign that card asking for a vote on a union?
No, I don't have any idea.
It forms the union. And they say, you're now in a union. You say, no, we were going to have a vote on whether or not to have a union. And they say, no, you signed the card check. And said, and if you're answered, well, I signed the card so we can have a vote, and then a majority can decide whether we want to be in the union or not. The union says, no, once you've signed the card check, you're in the union. We will have a vote later on, but right now, for now, you're in the union. And I think it is one of the sleaziest union tactics, and that's saying something, that unions employ to trick people into being in unions. Now, I didn't get a reply back from him when I asked, well, what do you mean by not having a full deal? But it sounds like they are a brand new union that has not managed to negotiate its first contract. But if you're not interested in being in a union, you have no interest in it, but they've formed a union around you, why would somebody like that go to a union meeting when they are not in favor of being in a union?
Well, in order to steer things the way you want it to go.
No, but you don't want to be in the group.
To exercise your voice.
Well, but hold on, your voice.
If you're in the union, you're in the union.
And
what
do you think of that?
All you can do then is work from the inside. But I have no issue with your opinion of unions tricking people to become unions. That's not right.
Okay, and I agree with you. And in fact, they've forged signatures. They've done a lot of really sleazy things that are now in the courts. Tommy, I wish the unions would operate the way most organizations do. I'm a member of the NRA. I quit at one point because I was unhappy with something they'd done regarding the First Amendment. They sold people out for a time, and I just said, fine, I quit. I had been a life member. I rejoined when I was persuaded that they had changed their position 180 degrees. If unions had to work to get their members and convince their members that handing somebody $1,000 a year with most of it going to political contributions and not to representing me, if you want to convince somebody that that's the best thing, good. But do you think that people in Oregon and Washington should be forced to be a member of a union just because they work at a place that has a union?
Well, it's pretty much necessary for the union to work.
It is not, Tommy. More than half the states.
Are different. There are places.
No,
that have
more than Oregon and Washington are not right-to-work states. Half the states in America are right-to-work states. You can go to work at a union workplace, and you can join or not join. It's up to you. In Oregon and Washington, if you go to work for somebody who has a union in their workplace, you are forced to be a member. Does that sound like an American idea to you?
You got me. I don't know.
Yeah, sounds like it. Tommy, thank you very much. Back in a moment. It's the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Gentlemen, you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars. Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and it's Radio Northwest Network. I'll tell you what, I want to talk to you about something that is almost unbelievable. But imagine this, a district attorney who runs for office on the campaign that he is going to stop prosecuting people. And then once he gets in office, he declines to prosecute thousands of criminal cases. And that has the predictable result that the community where he's the DA, Multnomah County, ends up being just completely beset by crime. So the voters go to the polls, and even in a crazy liberal place like Multnomah County, they say, we've had enough of this guy, and they vote him out of office by a sizable majority. So what does he do in his last 6 months, because he's DA until the first of next year? He does as much damage as he possibly can, and he gives a big middle finger to anybody who cares about enforcing the law. Now, I think that describes Mike Schmidt for Brains, who is the current DA but will be out in January, but he's deliberately damaging criminal cases that are the bread and butter of district attorneys throughout the Northwest. Josh Marquis is a former DA, and he knows this problem well. Josh, welcome back.
Thank you. To explain what's happening, there are two kinds of criminal.
No, Josh, don't get started. No, we'll get into the details of this in a moment.
What Schmidt has done is said in all misdemeanors, he has ordered his deputy DAs that they may not use what are called peremptory challenges, which is finding out, for example, if potential jurors hate the cops or won't be fair. And it's the kind of back and forth anybody who's been on a jury is probably familiar with. He has basically crippled his misdemeanor prosecutors and ordered them that they are not allowed to use any peremptory challenges, meaning that they're essentially going into court with one hand and one foot tied behind their back. And
now, where I wanted to start with this, Josh, where I wanted to start with this is I want people to understand. We always hear about the DA's office or the prosecutor's office when it comes to murder and rape and the big high-profile crimes. But you pointed out to me, the actual day-to-day bread and butter of a DA's office is hundreds and hundreds of possible misdemeanors, correct?
Absolutely. Drunken violence cases like that.
Okay. And in this case, he's saying he's not going to do this on the more serious cases, but he is going to do this on misdemeanor cases, which affect the quality of life dramatically. Is there any other predictable result to taking away peremptory challenges from the prosecutors, while the defense attorneys still get to use peremptory challenges to, say, remove a juror who clearly believes in law and order, believes in convicting the guilty, etc.? The defense attorney can still remove those people, but Schmidt for Brains is saying, I'm going to prevent my prosecutors from getting the same advantage that is built into the law to give them peremptory challenges too. Isn't that going to have the predictable outcome that will mean that fewer people will be convicted of crimes they committed?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you're crippling the prosecutor. I mean, there are arguments that maybe should be rid of peremptory challenges altogether, but that means both sides. It doesn't mean one side can't do it. And predictably, what will happen is it'll be younger, newer deputy DAs, and people might say, I think you even asked me, well, can't they just refuse to do this? Yeah, and they could lose their jobs. Schmidt is still the DA for another 4.5 months. And theoretically, if someone said, this is unethical, I won't do it, he could say, fine, you don't have a job anymore. Now, the DA starting January 1 is a good guy named Nathan Vasquez. But in the meantime, this appears to be deliberate sabotage by Mike Schmidt of the criminal justice system. And yes, these aren't just bread and butter cases. Most people, when they hear about assault in the fourth degree, harassment, reckless driving, drunk driving, these are all misdemeanors. And believe me, you do not want to live in a community where basically it's open season and people who commit these crimes aren't held accountable.
Is there at least
the next consequence in Oregon?
Is there at least one elected official in the state who could step in and act in this case?
Absolutely. The governor of the state has the absolute power to remove from office any district attorney, local DA, who refuses or is unable to carry out their duties. And it has happened before. If we had a governor worth her damn, Tina Kotek would immediately write a letter to Schmidt and say, Mr. Schmidt, you are refusing to enforce the law. The voters of Multnomah County have already said who they want the DA to be. I am removing you from office, and I am appointing Mr. Vasquez effective immediately.
And in fact, Schmidt could do the same thing, because I reminded you that way back when Schmidt took office 4 years ago, he had been elected in a May election, and the DA, who I think was a coward, Rod Underhill, I always called him Rod Underdog, just said, oh, they elected the new guy, well, I'm going to leave 6 months early and hand it over to him August the 1st. And I suggested when Vasquez beat Mike Schmidt, I said, Schmidt should do the right thing. The voters have rejected his work as a DA, and they rejected it soundly and said, we don't want him in the office anymore. He should go to Vasquez and say, I'll let you take over August 1st and start your new policies as the voters have chosen. Instead, he's telling the voters, I don't care what you want, and I'm going to do as much damage to the criminal justice system on the way out as I possibly can.
That is exactly what he's doing. And you're right. I mean, it's one thing if it's just a change in administrations, but this is, as you point out, a radical voter said enough. That, and people, anybody who was paying attention in Portland knows this was a very, very bitter campaign. It cost millions of dollars on both sides, and voters made a clear choice. And it wasn't for Mike Schmidt.
I mean, what is he trying to accomplish beyond this, other than to be remembered as a guy who really screwed things up on the way out the door? And he's not just pulling the V's off the computer keyboards on his way out the door as Vasquez comes in. He's actually going to damage real people here.
I suspect, I don't know him well, but I know him a little bit, he honestly believes that his constituency are basically the people accused of crimes, the people who commit crimes. He doesn't see the victims and the ordinary people of Multnomah County as the people he ought to be servicing. He thinks the accused and downtrodden are in fact the criminals. And basically we have a defense attorney as DA.
Wow. Okay, anything else we can do? Because I'm not holding my breath for Tina Kotek to do anything about this.
No. There's not much they can do other than people could rise up in Multnomah County. That's just not going to happen.
Well, and for example, if you had reporters worth their salt who would go to Tina Kotek and say, Governor, the DA of Multnomah County, the most populous county in the state, has decided not to enforce the law and go after criminals with everything allowed under the law, will you demand that he either start doing his job or be removed from office? Except that nobody in this state or region seems to want to do that kind of thing. To say to the governor, why don't you act in this case? If the DA has decided to throw cases in favor of criminals, will you act? And if enough people came to her and put her on TV saying, no, I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to let Mike Schmidt show, do all the damage he can on his way out the door. If she does that, she gets the political heat for it. Instead, the reporters are letting Governor Kotek get away with doing absolutely nothing, which is pretty much her, you know, that's what she does, standard operating procedure. That's DA Josh Markey. Back in a moment. I want to talk about immigration and the border front and center with Border Czar Kamala Harris running for president. And what do Americans say about that? Some.
Facebook, X, and Google may censor you, but you'll never find censorship here.
Don't censor me!
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, although what I see going on in Washington, D.C. is absolutely shameful. Let me describe some of what's happened in the last few hours. Number one, massive mobs of people outside of the United States Congress. These are pro-Hamas terrorism supporters in America who are there to protest against Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of one of America's best allies on planet Earth and our only real ally, our best ally at least, in the Middle East. And what are these pro-Hamas terrorist protesters doing? They've been taking down the flags in front of Union Station and burning them, the American flag. They've been putting up Palestinian flags. They've been spray painting and vandalizing a number of the Liberty Bells and other monuments that are there. They're just doing destructive activity. And all of this in name of telling Americans why they support a terrorist organization. But before I get to your calls, I want to talk a little bit about immigration, because that's been a subject on this show for the better part of about 30 years. And immigration and the border, I think, are going to be front and center in this year's presidential contest. Can you imagine a time when it has been more on point than it is today? We stand here at about 3.5 years into the Joe Biden criminal organization that has been running the White House. And what do we have to show for it? 12 to 15 million illegal aliens who've invaded America in just the last 3.5 years. 12 to 15 million illegal aliens. And before that, under Donald Trump, the United States had one of the most secure southern borders we've ever seen. So the contrast is really a bright line. You've got an open borders administration in Joe Biden, and I guarantee that when reporters start asking presidential candidate Kamala Harris about whether or not she's in favor of open borders, she's going to try to find a warm and fuzzy way to describe it that makes it sound like a great idea. But I'm going to tell you right now that Americans aren't buying it, and I've got a great set of poll numbers that describe roughly where the American public stands on this. I never believe that public opinion polls are absolutely accurate, but they do tend to tell you which direction the wind is blowing on any given subject. Before I do that, if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. So there is a brand new poll, the Harris poll, that has come out, and there's a Gallup survey as well, if you want to compare the two of them. And what it does is it asks Americans a number of questions about illegal aliens, about the proposed mass deportations that President Trump has proposed. Now, when President Trump proposed that, and he did it some time ago, he said, when I'm reelected, we're going to have the biggest deportation of illegal aliens in American history. That's virtually a direct quote. He said it time and again. So there's no mistaking what he plans to do. So what did they do? The Gallup poll went out and they asked Americans. They did the survey in March and April. So this is a couple of months old. But it shows that 51% of the general public supports the policy of mass deportation of illegal aliens. Now, the highest support came from Republicans at about 68%. The lowest support, strikingly enough, is from Black Americans, who only supported it by 40%. Even though I would argue that a great many Black Americans work in lower-end jobs, economically lower-end jobs, and they are the ones most likely to be affected adversely by illegal alien workers, because Joe Biden's plan is clearly to let these millions of people come illegally into the country with no regard to our immigration laws, to legitimize their status here, although he can't legalize their status here without a change in the law. Now, he could have just continued the Trump policies from before him, and we would have continued to have a secure southern border. Instead, he wiped out, with executive orders, almost everything that Trump had done, the Remain in Mexico policy, Title 42, and the rest of those. And what do they get? Well, you got millions of illegal aliens. Now, you say, but they don't have the right to work. Most of them do not. That's true. Are they going to work anyway? Yes, they will. Will they work under the table and illegally? Yes, they will. Will they pay taxes? Don't bet on it. So What do you find out? Half of Americans, including 42% of Democrat Americans, say they support mass deportations. 30% of Democrats and 46% of Republicans say they would end birthright citizenship right now. Now, imagine that. You've got a sizable number of Democrats and almost half of all Republicans. And to understand birthright citizenship, this is a key one. I see reports that say, well, this is guaranteed by the Constitution in the 14th Amendment. It is not. What the Constitution says is that if you are born on American soil and your parents are under the jurisdiction of the United States, that means you had to come in legally. So if your mom came in legally to the United States on a tourist visa, a business visa, if they came in on a green card and they bear a child, that child is an American citizen. If they came in illegally, under the 14th Amendment, they are not under the jurisdiction of the United States of America, then you're not a citizen. Now, that's never been challenged in court, but it should be. The current way it's treated is stumble across the border, drop a baby, 5 minutes later, the baby is an American anchor baby, and it will give that child American citizenship. That is an improper interpretation of the 14th Amendment. And I've talked to legal scholars about why it is, and they've explained it. Now, 55% of U.S. adults, a solid majority, want to see immigration levels reduced. And at this point, you say, well, what's the right level? I'd ask you the question right back. During the time of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, we had about 300,000 people legally emigrating to the United States, 300,000 every year. Now, at the end of 10 years, that's 3 million people, and the average person who's made a new citizen usually applies for what's called family reunification, meaning once you're here, once you're a citizen, you can invite family members to come in, and the average green card who becomes a citizen brings in an average of 3 family members. So if you bring in 3 million people legally, and then you allow each one of those 3 million to bring in 3 people, another 9 million, and bring them in under family reunification, that is 12 million people in 10 years. If you legalize the status of the 15 million that Joe Biden has allowed to come into the United States in the last 3.5 years, and then you give them family reunification, which is, a you know, under the law, you can do it, we're talking about a total number north of 50 million additional people in the United States. And in that case, just remember, many of these people are not the best educated. Many of them do not speak the language. Many of them do not hew to the kind of requirements in American culture. And a pungent reminder of that is 14 and 15-year-old girls who've been sexually assaulted by illegal aliens. And why? Well, because back at home, 14-year-olds are sexually available. Well, in America, that's called rape. It's called child molestation. You've got to adopt our culture. When people tell me about multiculturalism and how it's so great, they're not talking about food. They're not talking about music. They're talking about a different culture that in many cases is antithetical to American culture. If you have a 14-year-old daughter or granddaughter, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And a majority of Americans favor mass deportations of illegal aliens. And Kamala Harris was border czar for 3.5 years. She's got a lot of questions to answer before the vote in November on the 5th. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Behind the scenes with leading Democrats after the presidential debate.
What's your backup plan? You got to have some kind of backup plan, right?
Yeah, we don't have a backup plan. This is it.
And this is the best that the U.S. government can come up with?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Well, we can kind of tell what the Democrat Party platform is all about. The protesters rioting in Washington, D.C. today, tearing down and burning American flags, putting up Palestinian flags, mobbing the United States Congress on Capitol Hill because they're angry that the prime minister of one of our biggest allies in the world, Israel, is speaking to a joint session of Congress, and dozens of Democrat Party members who simply said, no, I can't go and listen to that speech by Netanyahu. So I can tell where the Democrats are coming from. Their Republican platform is a way of, you know, as Jason Bedrick puts it, signaling to voters the things that the politicians are likely to pursue if they're elected to office. Jason, welcome to the program. And by the way, thanks for your work at the Heritage Foundation. What's on your mind? I want to talk to you about this universal school choice that I hope is going to be a mainstay for Republicans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a huge development. The Republican Party, for a number of years in their platform, has endorsed school choice policies. But this is the first time that they've upped the bar and explicitly endorsed universal school choice, which is to say that every single child in the country who is eligible to be enrolled in a K-12 school would be eligible for a school choice policy like vouchers or tax credit scholarships or education savings accounts that empower families to choose the learning environments that align with their values and work best for their kids.
You know, Jason, one of the things that's always attracted me to that is people will tell me, they'll call and say, no, we can't have that because it'll destroy the public schools. And I said, well, maybe they deserve to be destroyed, but they have a chance to survive when their kids start leaving the school, when parents pull them out of K-12 government-run public schools and put them into private schools and charter schools and online schools and every other form using those vouchers. The public schools can do what everybody else who has to compete in the world has to do, and that is either up your game and come up to standards and provide a product that's attractive or go out of business. There's nothing wrong with that equation, is there?
No. I mean, actually, the whole premise of that argument displays a remarkable lack of faith in the public school system. It assumes that if parents were given a choice and that instead of their tax dollars just being taken from them and put into the system, those tax dollars would follow the child to the learning environment of their choice, that parents would not choose the public system. There'd be this mass exodus, and the public school system would collapse. And it also sort of treats children as funding units instead of recognizing that the system is built for the kids, not the other way around. But the reality is actually the reverse. The reality is we've got more than two dozen academic studies that have looked at the effect of school choice policies on public school performance, and almost all of them have found a statistically significant positive effect, which is to say that just like every other area of life where you have choice and competition, it improves performance. School choice is the rising tide that lifts all boats.
Yeah, because the indictment I'd laid down on the public schools, and I've had too many people, Jason, politicians, come on this show and say, oh, we have to make sure we adequately fund our fantastic schools. And I'll ask them, are they really fantastic? And they'll say, well, of course they are. I have to say that because otherwise people would think, and I say, hold on, 70% of kids can't read or do math at eighth grade at an adequate level. That's our excellent school system. And then they'll acknowledge, oh yeah, you're right, they kind of fail, but there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. Well, you can't fix a lot of those. I mean, people wish for better parents or a better environment for the kids and everything else, but how about fixing the thing you can fix? Tell the schools to do the job well, and if they don't do it, parents have a right to go elsewhere. That's how, as you said, everything else in the world works. I mean, sports works that way. Business works that way. Retail and commerce works that way. If I don't like a grocery store and I don't think I'm getting what I want from the grocery store, I take my business somewhere else. And that applies to everything else except public schools.
That's right. And, you know, look, if money were what made the difference, then in Washington, D.C., where they're spending about $35,000 per pupil, we should have some of the best public schools in the country instead of some of the worst. Throwing money at a broken system doesn't do anything to address the problem. You have to fundamentally change the incentives. Right now, schools, public schools, are not directly accountable to parents. Parents learned that the hard way during COVID. Those public schools are accountable to unelected bureaucrats and elected politicians and special interests like the teachers unions that operate in the system. In order to make the system directly responsible to parents, the money has to follow the child. So when the school is not meeting that child's needs, the family can move the child out of the school and the money follows the child.
Well, and do you remember the outrageous statement from the guy who wanted to be Virginia governor, Terry McAuliffe, who stood up there and said, parents have no business telling us what we teach your kids. I mean, there's almost an arrogance from one side, from the Democrat Party, saying, yeah, we've got the schools. You have nothing to say about how or what we teach your kids or whether or not we do a good job.
Yes, and you know they denigrate parents. You know, we're the experts. You just give your kids to us. We'll take it from here. And yet they have proven over and over again that their expertise is not worth the hill of beans. You know, these are the same people who told us that closing down the schools was not going to have any effects. Zoom school is going to be just as effective as in-person education. They're the same people that can't define what a woman is and are putting biological males in the girls' locker rooms. So there's no reason that parents should be deferring to their expertise, especially when over and over again we have seen that studies on the effectiveness of school choice have shown that students improve when they're going to the learning environment that their parents choose. So parents are doing a much better job than bureaucrats at figuring out what works best for their kids.
I'm talking to Jason Bedrick, who's a research fellow at the Center for Education Policy at Heritage. One thing, this isn't a national party platform, but isn't almost all the legwork on this going to have to be done at the state level? There isn't really a way to impose universal school choice from the Congress, or is there?
No, it is mostly going to be at the state level. And even if you look at the Republican Party platform, it says we support universal school choice in every state in America. What we should be doing at the federal level is reducing the federal role. We should be getting rid of the Department of Education and restoring the locus of control to families and local communities. And so, yes, this is going to be a state-by-state effort. And we've been making tremendous progress. 4 years ago, there wasn't a single state that had universal ESAs or education savings accounts. There are now 11 states that have universal school choice, all of them states that were controlled by the Republican Party. And I expect in the coming years, we're going to add to a number of states to that number.
Jason, would you mind reminding my audience what happened in Washington, D.C., a notoriously poor community outside of Congress, when they said we're going to allow a certain amount of money? I think it was during Bush, George W., that they did that, didn't they? And they got a tremendous response, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And families are very excited to have opportunity scholarships, as they're called in Washington, D.C. Those students are performing at a higher level than their peers who aren't getting the scholarships. The Obama administration tried a few times to eliminate it. They zeroed out the program in their budget, but the Republican Congress kept it in there, and it survived the negotiation progress. I expect that we're going to see the opponents of school choice across the country trying to roll back these programs, but they haven't succeeded yet, because once families get a taste of education freedom, they don't want to give it up.
No, absolutely right. That's Jason Bedrick from the Center for Education Policy. Jason, it's a pleasure. When we come back, I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Summer.
Meanwhile, at Biden's campaign headquarters, they're working on a strategy.
They'll use it against you in the campaign. They'll try to prove that you're incompetent.
I can prove that as well as he can.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's a pleasure to be with you. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com. Randy Sutton joins me now, retired police lieutenant and founder of the Wounded Blue organization that's going to put on a big celebration of the men and women who serve in blue today. Randy, welcome to the program.
Bart, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Tell my audience about Light Up the Lake.
This is going to be one hell of an event. I am I'm so proud that Joanne Cantor, who has created this event for us, has taken the mission of the Wounded Blue to heart and realized the amazing things that the Wounded Blue does in supporting injured and disabled officers across the country, including, of course, Portland and Oregon. And so Light Up the Lake was her This is her child, if you will. This was her idea, and this is turning into a massive event that's going to support law enforcement in the area. It's going to be held in Lake Oswego, and it's going to be, there's actually two events. On the 27th, there's a VIP event at a beautiful mansion on the lake, and that's $1,000 a ticket to get in. That's going to be incredible food, entertainment, awards, all kinds of stuff. But then on the 28th is going to be Light Up the Lake at Lake Oswego in the park right next to the lake. And this is open to the public. It's, I believe, $25 a ticket to get in. Food, entertainment, an incredible showing of support for law enforcement in the area. And there's going to be lots of law enforcement there to accept the thanks from the people who are in the area who truly do support law enforcement. I was actually in Lake Oswego on July 4th at the 4th of July parade, and Wounded Blue had a float there. And I got to tell you, Lars, I felt like I was walking in a time tunnel.
A time before Antifa and defund the police.
You got it. That's exactly right. There were 20,000 fans of true Americana that lined the parade route, and it was cheering. It was blowing kisses. It was smiles. It was beautiful. And the showing of support for the Wounded Blue there and law enforcement in general was absolutely. It was heartwarming.
Can get back to that kind of America sometime very, very soon if certain political changes happen. One of them does not involve electing somebody, and I know you can't get political, but I will. It does not involve electing somebody who actually said the Antifa riot should continue and raising money to bail them out of jail and things like that, but I won't drag you down that road. If people want more information on Light Up the Lake coming up this weekend, where can they find it online?
Well, they can find it at our website. That is thewoundedblue.org. That's thewoundedblue.org. And then just go down to the events, and you'll click on that event button, and you can get a ticket for it. And really, I'm going to be there all weekend. I would love for your listeners to come participate. And if they want to contact me directly and talk about the Wounded Blue, I'm really easy to find. I'm randy@thewoundedblue.org. But I don't want you to think that I can't be political, because I was actually the law enforcement speaker in Milwaukee just last week at a Republican National Convention, where I called out that certain political party.
Well, you know, it's just, Randy, I just think we have rarely had a choice that is this clear cut, where you have the one side that was supported by Antifa in one way or another, by BLM, by the riots that took 36 lives, caused $3 billion in damage. And then you got the other side, the law enforcement side, which I would say is the Donald Trump side of things. So if people want a safe America again, I think there's only one direction to go. But Randy, I appreciate that. Light of the Lake is happening this weekend. Let me get to your calls. Let me start with Hal. Hey, Hal, welcome to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, curious if you thought that, well, first off, let me ask you, what is the best pick, not for the Dems, but the best pick that Kamala Harris could make as vice president?
Well, she's not going to get elected, so that's factor one. Factor two, the people she's considering are Josh Shapiro and apparently Pete Buttigieg, who's done an absolutely awful job as transportation secretary, which shouldn't surprise you, who's an awful mayor of a small town from Indiana. So when you say the best pick, you mean the one most likely to get her elected or the one most likely not to get her elected?
Right, the one that you would pick if she was to, quit.
I hate to be technical about this, but she gets the pick. I mean, she's not exactly going to be bringing the potato salad to the Mensa Day picnic. So I don't know who she's going to pick. It'll probably be a dumb choice. She was a bad pick. She was an affirmative action hire, a DEI hire by Joe Biden. He said, I'm going to pick a woman who's black. And he did. And she showed her stripes as vice president, being assigned the job of border czar. By all accounts, she avoided the border as much as she could. And the problem got about 10 times worse under her watch. She's got a lot to answer for. Al, thanks for the call. 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday and live on the Radio Northwest Network, going out to every corner of the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. Now, I always tell you, if I have a dog in the fight, I pay the tax that we're about to talk about, the tax that supports the scam that I consider Washington Cares. Washington Cares, in theory, says that everybody should have protection should they need some long-term care, either because they're getting older or because they've suffered some kind of either medical malady or an accident that puts them in a position where they need long-term care. Except that I think this whole thing is a giant scam, charging a lot of people money that they can't afford to give up, and then saying to them, you might get some benefit out of it someday, but it isn't going to be much, and it isn't going to protect you for very long. Now, Elizabeth New, and I have talked about this a number of times, she's a research analyst and director of the Center for Worker Rights and Healthcare at Washington Policy. Elizabeth, welcome back.
Hi, Lars. You're exactly right. And not only is it not enough money, it's not even guaranteed. That's the worst part. They're selling false promises and false hope to people to have money to care for long-term care needs if they have them.
And in fact, they call this insurance, but it's not even that. The state collects a bunch of money. There's no guarantee that the taxes they collect are even going to pay the benefits they're going to start paying out. And there will be a lot of people who will pay into the system and never be able to collect a dime, which is where I think the scam part gets especially strong. But last week, I talked to a lady from AARP, an organization that I don't particularly like because they helped pass Obamacare. And I had her on because she was part of a group that said, no, say no on Initiative 2124 that's coming up for a vote in Washington State this November. 2124, if it passes, doesn't completely get rid of Washington Cares, but it makes major changes. Her group would like voters to vote no on it. And when I talked to her, she made a number of representations, and you told me later by email, you said a lot of what she said just simply flat out wasn't true. Why don't we talk about a couple of those things first?
Go for it. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I had asked her, I said, well, what's the cost of long-term care? And she said, well, it's about $5,000 a month. Now, that is not truly the cost of getting a family member into any kind of long-term care facility, or is it?
No. The estimates are showing, I look at industry numbers all the time, and they're showing nursing home costs, which is what a lot of us think of as long-term care that people need, is up in the $150,000-plus range, I believe. I'd have to look again.
Per year.
$148,000.
Yeah, per year.
And to have a 20-person in-home caregiver is closer to the amount she mentioned. And that's because while CARES is based off of a Medicaid model, and that's the key thing here, Medicaid is set up to be a safety net for people in financial need of long-term care. While CARES is not that safety net, while CARES is a tax on people to offer some workers money should they need it, and creates winners and leaders, winners and losers regardless of need. And the WalkCare supporters seem to have latched onto the message that passing 2124 will cost taxpayers, one that will actually save workers money directly who opt out, and is more than likely than not to save all Washington workers. That's because I don't think the program will be seen as viable by lawmakers if the initiative passes and people opt out, and the legislature can finally dump WellCares and get to finding real solutions for long-term care.
Well, and that's the other thing you said was if you got a little bit of help at home, and they talk about 20 hours of assistance per week, which works out to about 3 hours a day. So in other words, am I imagining this right? If your disability that puts you in need of some help leaves you at home and you need somebody, say, to come to your home every day, help you out of bed, maybe help you get through, you know, taking a shower, getting cleaned up, getting dressed, and then maybe make you breakfast and leave some lunch in the refrigerator. That's what 3 hours a day is going to cover, right?
Yeah. And, you know, that's what they envision. Family caregivers getting paid to provide Medicare, Medicaid administration, you know, making sure mom or dad takes the pill, giving them meals, things like that. And really what this program is about saving the state money it's paying right now in Medicaid long-term care costs and creating a jobs program that adds to union benefits for SEIU.
Because the state will go in, as they have in so many states, including Oregon, and say, all of you are home care workers. We're going to unionize all of you, and then you'll be making you'll give $1,000 a year to your union, and the union will give 80% of that to Democrat politicians. Am I missing anything there?
That's the concern. And at the very least, they're going to have family caregivers taking a training that is approved of by a state union, so there's access given right there from the beginning.
I mean, because if
the
it
rules
sounds like
have not been made yet.
No, and Elizabeth, if all I need is a few hours of assistance like that, my disability in that case, whether it's short or long term, is going to have to be pretty mild, isn't it? This isn't somebody sitting with you all day long. This isn't somebody helping you around 8 hours a day or 16 hours a day or 24 hours a day. It's a few hours of help. And then, you know, and then you're on your own. And so even that kind of benefit, and at that would cost, what would that cost per month to do it for a year? It pretty well wipes out the entire benefit, doesn't it?
Well, you know, people do prefer to age in place, to stay at home. But if you need long-term care, if you cannot get up to go to the bathroom, if you cannot wash yourself, if you cannot take medications, we're talking about getting right back up there to the cost of nursing homes. And so this is not a solution that people are going to be able to count on, even if they do qualify for WellCares, and many hurdles have been erected to keep people from this money. That's the only way it kind of sort of pencils out in good scenarios. Even if they get the money, they're going to need much more typically to cover long-term care costs if they truly have long-term care needs that require oversight by someone.
And by the way, if I've already got Medicare available to me, I've already got Medicaid available to me that I'm paying for through my taxes, then this is just, as you said, a way for the state to shift that cost onto a brand new tax so the state doesn't have to pay for the care they're providing right now.
Well, Medicare does not pay for long-term care, neither does Medicaid, except for people in financial need. And that's the real key here. We keep adding people to the Medicaid rolls. We keep allowing people to claim to be poor to get these Medicaid long-term care dollars in their pockets. And these people often have resources that they could put toward their long-term care needs, and they're having other taxpayers pick up the bill.
Doesn't make any sense. That's Elizabeth New, who's a research analyst and director of the Center for Worker Rights at Washington Policy. Elizabeth, thanks so much. I appreciate the time. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, whose speech was ignored by dozens of Democrats and the president, vice president. We're going to talk about that. Are you
Kamala? If reelected, he will be a dictator on day one.
Versus Trump.
What the hell did I do for democracy? Last week, I took a bullet for democracy.
Let the games begin. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Remember one thing from the speech. Remember this. Our enemies are your enemies. Our fight is your fight. And our victory will be your victory.
That is Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, our best ally in the Middle East. And he was speaking before the United States Congress. Except I'm absolutely required to mention to you, he was speaking in front of a Congress from which dozens and dozens of members of the House and Senate in this joint session had decided they didn't want to be there. They didn't want to be in the same room as Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, do I think that was a sensible choice? Well, it was Democrats exclusively who made that choice, saying, I will not be in the same room with Benjamin Netanyahu from Israel, whether they're our ally or not. Now, if that gives you an added idea of the attitude of the Democrats toward Israel, toward the war in Gaza, toward hostage-taking terrorist organizations like Hamas, I think you've got the right impression at that point. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Every time I've seen Benjamin Netanyahu give a speech before the Congress or in the United States, I routinely get emails from people saying, why can't we get a guy like that to be president of the United States? And for years, I had no answer for that. Today, the answer is Donald Trump, because I think Trump is just as tough as Netanyahu and probably just as embattled as Netanyahu has been. He's been criticized by people in his own country. He's certainly been criticized by America's left. And guess what happened? Not only did Benjamin Netanyahu and his wife fly into Washington, D.C. yesterday, and when they got off the plane, was President Joe Biden there? No. Joe Biden decided to stiff Netanyahu on his arrival. Was Vice President Kamala Harris, now presidential candidate Kamala Harris, was she there to greet this leader of an ally in the Middle East? And the answer is no. How about Secretary of State Anthony Blinken? Was he there? No. They sent a junior league staffer to greet the leader of one of our best allies on planet Earth. And then dozens and dozens of members of Congress pointedly refused to show up to hear the Prime Minister of Israel. Now, Rashida Tlaib was in the audience. She is a Democrat. And if you say, well, she was there, you know what happened? She showed up. But she was wearing one of those kafias, the thing that looks like a tablecloth, black and white checks. And basically, it is to signal solidarity with that piece of cloth means a lot in the Middle East. It's to suggest that she's with Hamas. She's with the Palestinians. She's with the terrorists who are currently holding hostages, including American hostages. I mean, in a lot of ways, what Rashida Tlaib did today would be like showing up at a speech by a black politician in America wearing a white hood over your head. I mean, that's Rashida Tlaib's approach to this nonsense. And right now, thousands of Muslims and pro-Hamas demonstrators are absolutely wreaking mayhem in downtown Washington, D.C. In the last few hours, they have taken down and burned American flags. They have replaced them with Palestinian flags. They have scrawled graffiti and damaged so many monuments and so many artifacts in the city of Washington, D.C. They had all of this so-called demonstration. I'm sure there will be a few TV reporters running around saying it was mostly peaceful, except for the burning stuff, except for the attacks on the police. And then you've got Kamala Harris, who would not show up. She's supposed to preside over joint sessions of the House and Senate. She refused to do it. You know what she was doing instead? She was out giving a speech to a conference of American sororities. So apparently doing that was more important. But I want to go back to Netanyahu, because he's a very good speaker, and he knows enough that when he comes to America to say he understands that his problem, as he said in that first soundbite, is really our problem too. And he started with some of the supporters of Hamas right here in America.
Many anti-Israel protesters, many choose to stand with evil. They stand with Hamas. They stand with rapists and murderers. They stand with people who came into the kibbutzim, into a home. The parents hid the children, the two babies, in the attic, in a secret attic. They murdered the families, the parents. They found the secret latch to the hidden attic, and then they murder the babies. These protesters stand with them. They should be ashamed of themselves.
I couldn't agree more that they should be ashamed of themselves. And yet you've seen that. And then Netanyahu centered in on the college protests that we've seen over the last 6 or 8 months.
We recently learned from the National Security Director, U.S. Director of National Intelligence, that Iran is funding and promoting anti-Israel protests in America. They want to disrupt America. So these protesters burn American flags even on the 4th of July. And I wish to salute the fraternity brothers at the University of North Carolina who protected the American flag, against these anti-Israel protesters.
Now, I want to mention something at this point. You say, well, why is it we're not hearing the Biden administration complain that Iran is funding some of the anti-Israel, anti-American protests? And the answer is because the Biden administration has been doing everything it can to help Iran. Joe Biden has refused to enforce sanctions against Iran that were enforced under Donald Trump. Donald Trump left the Iranians just about bankrupt at the end of his term of office. Joe Biden came right in and managed to make sure that they got a lot of money through oil, through unfrozen assets, through not enforcing sanctions. And then Netanyahu took to task these protesters as just being plain old ignorant. Listen.
Absolutely amazing. Some of these protesters hold up signs proclaiming gays for Gaza. They might as well hold up signs saying chickens for KFC. These protesters chant from the river to the sea, but many don't have a clue what river and what sea they're talking about. They not only get an F in geography, they get an F in history. They call Israel a colonialist state? Don't they know that the land of Israel is where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob prayed, where Isaiah and Jeremiah preached, and where David and Solomon ruled?
Yeah, apparently they don't know that either. And he also took issue with the International Criminal Court, the ICC, trying to shut down Israel's efforts to defend itself against these terrorist organizations like Hamas.
The ICC is trying to shackle Israel's hands and prevent us from defending ourselves. And if Israel's hands are tied, America is next. And I'll tell you what else is next. The ability of all democracies to fight terrorism will be imperiled. That's what's on the line. So let me assure you, the hands of the Jewish state will never be shackled. Israel will always defend itself.
I want you to hear this last one where Netanyahu talks about Iran funded by Joe Biden.
That's why the mobs in Tehran chant death to Israel before they chant death to America. For Iran, Israel is first, America is next. So when Israel fights Hamas, we're fighting Iran. When we fight Hezbollah, we're fighting Iran. When we fight the Houthis, we're fighting Iran. And when we fight Iran, we're fighting the most radical and murderous enemy of the United States of America. And one more thing. When Israel acts to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons that could destroy Israel and threaten every American city, every city that you come from, we're not only protecting ourselves, we're protecting you.
Sayers go to the head of the line at the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your calls, and we'll do that in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. You want to send an email? It's talk@LarsLarson.com. And, of course, you can always vote in our X poll. We used to call it the Twitter poll. Now it's the X poll. You know how social media goes these days. Today's question, should the Secret Service, which failed Donald Trump miserably by failing to protect him from an assassin's bullet, he didn't die, but he was hit in the head in the ear, should it demand that he stop his huge rallies? Imagine this. The Secret Service says, hey, we failed, so we can't protect you anymore, so stop having those huge outdoor rallies right in the middle of a presidential campaign. You can find the X poll question at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. And I always confess to you, if I have a dog in the fight, I have an 8-year-old granddaughter that I care the world about. Payson, we want to make sure she is protected from things like social media. So I'm very curious about efforts to try to protect kids from social media. And Taylor Barkley joins me now, who's director of public policy at the Abundance Institute. Taylor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Tell me about this bill that is purportedly about protecting kids online and whether it actually does that or not.
Yes, there are actually two bills coming up here, Lars, for a procedural vote on Thursday of this week, according to Majority Leader Schumer. And they are the Kids Online Safety Act and the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act 2.0. And they both do slightly different things. And I think the Kids Online Safety Act, COSA, K-O-S-A, as it's referred to in shorthand, applies a duty of care to social media platforms and to hold them accountable for not, bringing products that would promote mental health disorders like anxiety, eating disorders, and things like that. And it puts the Federal Trade Commission in charge of enforcing whether or not the platform has, complied with that duty of care. And the other bill, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, updates an existing law, also COPPA, raises the age of, allowing websites, platforms to collect and advertise data from 13-year-olds and up to 17-year-olds. So it raises the age limit. And these bills are very concerning for a number of reasons. But, the bottom line is they will not help keep children and teens safe online.
Well, I want you to make it clear to my audience because they may hear that and say, well, that sounds good. You're going to have tell all these companies you're on notice, keep the kids safe, keep the stuff away that might hurt the kids. And if you don't, the FTC will be breathing down your throat. Why are they not likely to work?
Well, they're so broadly defined, these terms in the duty of care provision, and it really leaves a ton of discretion to the Federal Trade Commission and state's attorneys general on, when a platform violates these terms. For example, a platform could be a breach of their duty of care if there's, content or services cause anxiety. A lot of things can cause anxiety. Seeing an alternate opinion, someone who disagrees with me could be grounds for a lawsuit. And one thing to note about the Federal Trade Commission is that it is 5 commissioners that are appointed by the president. So if there's a Republican president in office, it's going to be a mostly Republican commission, 3 Republican commissioners, 2 Democrats. But if it's a Democrat in the White House, it's going to be 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. So the policies and the lawsuits coming out of the Federal Trade Commission will align with whoever is in the White House. And, I'll note here, too, that it is significant today that Students for Life Action, a pro-life organization, came out against COSA, this Kids Online Safety Act, because they see the same issue with this duty of care language, that it could be very, very troubling for them as pro-life activists, having a Democrat-leaning Federal Trade Commission potentially breathing down their necks for, say, hey, you have this content that's pro-life, it's causing a lot of anxiety. And, then platforms are going to take this content down instead of risking millions of dollars in legal fees with the federal government.
Well, and it sounds like, Taylor, am I right in concluding that some of these social media companies, which I believe are a bit political themselves, it depends on the company, but some of them will use this as an excuse, saying, well, we had to filter that content for kids because we don't like, in honesty, they would say, we really don't like the political message, but we'll use COSA as the excuse to take it down, when in fact all they're doing is the same kind of political filtering that Twitter and Facebook or Meta and Google have been doing through the last election cycle.
You've hit the nail on the head. I think that's exactly right. I mean, they will do that under the cover of, well, we're just complying with the law out of an abundance of safety, and we will see more content removed rather than left up. So it will impact speech in a way, and it will. Another provision of this law, they'll need to know who is a minor and who's an adult. So there will probably be some level of age verification that's more onerous than we experience right now. There's trade-offs with this, right? Like, we do need to keep kids and teens safe on social media. That is a very important goal. But these bills are not the way to do that. And, you know, this aviating will just, I think it'll make services more expensive. It will, like we've seen already with the existing Child Online Privacy Protection Act, we don't see helpful tools designed for teens and children because of these onerous provisions. Instead, these kids and teens are treated like adults, and they're getting, you know, the full breadth of content. So these laws go too far in one direction and kind of blow past the effective point and open up doors to all sorts of mischief on the platform part, but also on the federal government's part.
I'm talking to Taylor Barkley, who's with the Abundance Institute. Well, the biz about age verification, I mean, how they end up doing that, because I would imagine the most direct route would be to say, well, you need to put in a credit card, or you need to put in driver's license information and personal information like your name and everything else. Because otherwise, how do you go about proving that somebody who's signing on for an online account is 15 years old or 55 years old? You can only do that by gathering a lot of data. And what happens to all that data?
That's right. It becomes a target for hacks, I think, for misuse. You know, as we've learned over the years with anything electronic, it's not 100% safe. The more data you provide, the higher the risk of harm comes about. So I think, and then of course, this just means that the government is saying, you know, you need to supply your papers before you can participate in, you know, political speech or posting photos of your family barbecue, which is a First Amendment violation. And I think we've seen over and over in the courts already with some of these state bills that require age verification. They're getting struck down for that exact thing.
Well, and in fact, if somebody said, and I have some younger people call the show, and I'm always glad when they do. But if they call them and say, I'm strongly pro-life, I'm 17 years old, I'm a young lady or a young man, and I'm 17 years old, but I really believe in pro-life because I'm pro-life. Yeah, even if they're pro, so-called pro, choice, or I call them pro-abortion, you know, to tell them you're only allowed to express your opinion online once you proved who you are with a bunch of other information about, say, you or people who are older who will verify that you are of age, all of that is gathering a lot of data that's also politically useful, isn't it?
That's true. Yeah, that could be a real issue. And I'll say, too, there's some irony here in that both of these bills, COSA and COPPA, purport to, you know, they put restrictions on the kinds of data that companies can collect, but at the same time, they're producing this legal standard that will, I think, just lead to platforms collecting the very information that they're trying to prohibit them from, gathering in the first place. So it's some deep irony in what these laws will require.
It is. And Taylor, since I assume that an awful lot of the social media companies are inherently liberal or run by liberals, imagine how useful that all that could be to political campaigns. Hey, we want to list all the 16 and 17-year-olds who are about to turn old enough to vote. We'd like to know where they live, what they're interested in, what their social media patterns are. And I'm sure that some of those companies will be happy to make use of it. That's Taylor Barkley from the Abundance Institute. Back in a moment. I'll get to your call at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Exercising the right to free speech every day. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. Should the Secret Service, which failed President Donald Trump on July 13th, fail to protect him from an assassin's bullet, a would-be assassin's bullet, the bullet did, or one of the bullets did, kill a member of the audience who were listening to Donald Trump on that day in Butler County, Pennsylvania. And now the Secret Service saying, having failed you, we've now decided to demand that Donald Trump stop his huge outdoor rallies, which have been a signature for Donald Trump for the last 4 years. For 4 years, that man has shown up almost anywhere in this country, and he draws either thousands or, in some cases, tens of thousands of people to listen to what he has to say. And now, all of a sudden, the Secret Service at this late date is saying, well, now we realize we can't protect you. I mean, what kind of agency is that anyway? Your job is to protect those protectees no matter what their circumstances are. You protect the president no matter which city he's in, no matter what kind of venue he's in, and you protect the candidates as well. And the Secret Service, it seems to me, is being used politically to say Donald Trump's massive outdoor rallies are a powerful political force. And let me tell you why they are. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris now have the advantage of incumbency. When you're able to say, I am the sitting president of the United States, or in her case, vice president of the United States, and you say that, that gives you a lot of exposure. The media pays close attention to what you have to say. And what we've discovered with Donald Trump, and I think he figured this out before anybody else did, if I go out and I hold a rally and I draw a crowd of 20 or 30,000 people, the media can't ignore it. I mean, Donald Trump could go out and give speeches to small groups and they would draw no attention whatsoever from the mainstream media. They could get away with ignoring him. And even CNN, which appears to hate Donald Trump with a passion, can't avoid the idea that putting him on TV is very, very good for their ratings. So they have to pay attention to what he does. If he is forced to go to smaller venues, that is going to put a crimp in his run for re-election to the presidency. And this is the Secret Service. If they could not protect him now in large outdoor venues, are they admitting that they haven't been able to protect him for years now, but they've ignored that problem and just allowed him to go exposed? Or are they saying there's some new failure? I mean, the fact is, the Secret Service is an agency that appears to have a gigantic bunch of problems. They've now shed their director, Kimberly Cheadle, who had no answers for Congress when she showed up in front of that congressional committee this week, and then resigns the next day. I assume she's going back to the private sector, although who wants to hire her at this point? But should the Secret Service now demand that Donald Trump stop his huge outdoor rallies? And if you say, well, they're just making it as a request. Listen, you understand how things get done. If the Secret Service goes to the candidate and says, if you keep holding these outdoor rallies, we won't be held responsible for what happens. Well, it appears that nobody at the agency except Kimberly Cheadle at the top is being held responsible. In fact, I'm waiting for them to tell us, who is it that's going to get fired for the bad judgments that were made on the ground in Butler County, Pennsylvania? Who's going to get fired for deciding we don't have to have more than two snipers sitting on one rooftop? We don't need to have a perimeter that's any bigger than 150 yards. We don't need to put an agent on top of the roof because, as Kimberly Cheadle now infamously has said, the roof was too steeply sloped for them. I mean, all of those sound very, very pathetic. So now the agency is effectively saying, we can't protect the candidates. Well, if they can't protect the candidates, they can't protect the president of the United States either. And that suggests a massive reform is needed at the U.S. Secret Service. Today's X-Poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. I want to give you two great pieces of news. I wish I could give you a good piece of news every single day. A brand new poll out shows that a plurality, 48%, so not quite a majority, a plurality of citizens plan to vote yes on the ballot measure to get rid of Washington State's Climate Commitment Act, a $2 billion scam on citizens in the state that put on a carbon tax that is not saving planet Earth. It is, in fact, just stripping a lot of money out of the pockets of a lot of people and handing it to the government with no requirement about where it's going to get spent. The survey done by King 5 and the Seattle Times and the University of Washington shows that 18% of voters are undecided about the carbon tax, but 48% would vote to repeal it, and only 34% would vote to keep that carbon tax. I would say that unless something changes dramatically between now and November 5th, that carbon tax is dead. And the second poll, the poll that shows that the initiative to get rid of the WA Cares program, They're going to get rid of that one. And another poll that's come out showing that Washington voters are fed up with the idea of the capital gains tax that was illegally imposed on Washington citizens. And no, I don't have a dog in the fight there. Capital gains tax on any assets over $260,000, 7% long-term capital gains tax, basically a tax that would only be paid by people like Jeff Bezos. And how did he respond? He moved out of state, took his assets with him. So voters, they're going to repeal that one as well. Yesterday's X poll, should we block the use of puberty blockers for transgender kids the way Great Britain has done? 97% yes. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars